Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm David Padil.
And I'm Saida Varsi. And welcome to A Muslim and a Jew Go There. And this week, we're swapping it up a bit again. We've had lots of questions in from you. In fact, so many that we're going to do two Q&A podcasts back to back. So this week and next week, we will be answering your questions. David, take it away with the first question.
Yeah, our first question is from Caroline Cook. And we've had a few questions about this. We've received a similar one from someone called Joanna Reynolds. I think there's generally been a number of people asking about some of the vocabulary that we've been using over the course of the podcast. And this specific one is, Caroline says, I would like to know why Saida and David routinely refer to there being an occupation by Israel. I feel this is a heavily loaded reference and it should not, in and of itself, just be bandied around. It is extremely reductive, Caroline thinks, to refer to the West Bank as occupied and wholly inaccurate to refer to Gaza as occupied. Now, you're the lawyer, Saida, so you know about international law and the technicalities of it. People just, I would say that people do use the word occupation all the time without probably knowing what in international law constitutes an occupation. So perhaps you can begin by helping us out there.
Yeah, well, first of all, a really great question. And I think language is important and how you describe things which are sensitive international disputes is important. And we've talked about it on this podcast, haven't we, David? But occupation is a legal term. And whether or not a land is occupied is something that is determined by law and supported by fact. And in this particular case, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem are not legally recognised as part of the State of Israel because in international law and according to United Nations resolutions and according to UK foreign policy, those are occupied territories. In fact, they're known as the occupied Palestinian territories.
Yeah, that's completely true. I guess the reason that Caroline is asking the question, though, is that as far as I understand it, a lot of Israeli supporters tend to be a bit ruffled by the idea, particularly of Gaza being occupied, because the Israelis left Gaza in 2005, having been there as an occupying military force for some time. They left there. They actually moved Jewish houses that were in Gaza out. And from then on, they were more like laying siege to Gaza and making it very difficult to come in and out of it. But does that still constitute an occupation, I guess, is the issue.
Yeah. And that's the second part of it. You're absolutely right. Is it in fact occupied? So in law, you can say these territories are designated as occupied territories and are seen as such by the UN and, of course, the International Red Cross. But in fact, are they occupied? And is what is happening in Gaza, let's say specifically, akin to occupation? I think for me, it depends on who controls the land, who controls the borders, who controls the air and who controls the sea. And if you look at Gaza through all of those prisms, then it is effectively occupied. I think the only way that I can describe it is that if you're living in your house, but whether or not you can come out of it, whether you can use the garden, when you can leave and when you can't, what you can have delivered by Amazon and how often, if all of that is not within your control, then you might be in your home, but you're not actually in control of it. Somebody else is telling you what you can and cannot do in all of those spheres. And if I give you an example, David, for Caroline and for Joanne, who have asked this question, if you take the case of Gazan fishermen, they're not allowed to go out and use the sea, which butts onto Gaza. They have officially, under the Oslo Accords, the right to use 20 nautical miles in reality, they're probably given access to about 5 or 6 nautical miles. And even within that, often the Israeli army will come in and stop them from fishing in those waters. Gaza doesn't have an airport. It's not allowed to have an airport. It's not allowed to have flights in and out. Gazans are not allowed to leave without permission. Goods are not allowed to get in without Israeli permission. So in effect, in reality, there is an occupation. If there was any dispute about whether or not Israeli forces controlled the whole strip, certainly after October, they definitely do.
Certainly after October the 7th. So I think, you know, I don't have much issue with the use of the word. And I feel it feels like a technicality to some extent. It doesn't feel like a military occupation before October the 7th in the same way that, say, Russia in Crimea does, because it seems to me that it is more slightly more akin to a siege. And of course, there is a border with Egypt, which is brought up quite a lot, again, by people wanting to make the case that it's not as simple as sometimes these words imply. And that I am confused, actually. I'm not aware of the Egyptian border being any easier to cross for Gazans than any of the Israeli borders being any easier, even though the military control of the Gaza Strip is obviously imposed by Israeli forces. Do you know? I don't know what the answer is, but how does that work?
So Rafah's interesting. Although strictly it's a Gaza-Egyptian border, the Israelis still have control over what comes in. So permissions have still got to be sought but from Israel before Egypt can implement it. It doesn't effectively control its own border with Gaza. And I think what Israel would say, not just in relation to Gaza, but also, interestingly, in relation to the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and in fact, the Syrian Golan Heights, is that these are all disputed territories rather than occupied territories. The Palestinians would say there was always intended to be two countries, an Israel and a Palestine. It might be disputed for you, but it's not for us because this is part of our right to self-determination and for us to have a state. And everywhere in the world, including the United Kingdom, believe that state will exist on 67 borders, of course, with some negotiations, but that effectively would mean that then Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights would be considered to be occupied territory.
Just to be clear, why did Israel disengage from Gaza in 2005 if effectively it is still occupied? 21 Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip were unilaterally dismantled and Israeli settlers evacuated. It was proposed in 2003, that disengagement, by Ariel Sharon and approved by the Knesset in 2005 as a disengagement plan. That is what it was called. Some settlers refused and they were evicted by Israeli security services over a period of several days and then relocated. The military met heavy resistance and riots from settlers while pulling out. Two far-right Israelis burnt themselves alive in protest of the withdrawal. That's interesting, isn't it, in terms of the understanding of the territory, because Sharon, of course, is not Netanyahu, but Sharon was presumably moving towards some kind of self-governance for the Gaza Strip and was prepared to do that in the face of settlers getting angry about it. It was 2007 that Hamas then became the government of Gaza, which may not have been what the Israeli government were hoping for when they pulled out, right?
In fact, I remember watching those scenes in 2005 and watching those last days as the settlers were told to leave. And I remember them burning their own houses, actually, as they left the Gaza Strip. But what had happened in the run-up to that is that little progress had been made on the Oslo Accords, which had always been about moving towards a level of self-governance in both of these places, Gaza and the West Bank. And I think the sense at that time was, and there's all sorts of theories about this, that what Israel wanted to do was really focus on the expansion of settlement building in the West Bank rather than use a huge amount of resources and trying to protect these really tiny settlements in Gaza, which were considered to be quite irrelevant in terms of land acquiring at that point, as opposed to the wider West Bank. And then what happened was within, I think, a year or so of them leaving, there was an election in the Gaza Strip and Hamas, democratically actually, through the ballot box, won control of Gaza. And then you ended up with these two authorities, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and then Hamas in Gaza. And I've talked about this in the past on the podcast, where I said that in the end, actually, this suited Netanyahu, because suddenly the Palestinian representation was split and they were actually at loggerheads with each other, the Palestinian Authority and the Gaza Strip.
I agree. That is definitely part of Netanyahu's plan. But interestingly, almost immediately following Israel's withdrawal, Hamas allowed Palestinian radicals to desecrate four synagogues. There were political reasons for the Israelis to withdraw from Gaza, but I don't think it was just about expanding settlements in the West Bank. I think that Sharon thought that economically and politically it would be easier to allow some kind of self-governance in the Gaza Strip. I just, as far as I'm aware, think that he didn't think Hamas were going to take control.
Yeah, I think the Gaza Strip was less relevant. I think with the discovery of offshore oil and gas in Gaza has made it far more relevant, both in terms of resources and long-term development. And I think there has been some talk now for some time that Israel has wanted to go back into Gaza. And unfortunately, tragically, on the 7th of October, Hamas gave them the reason to do that. What I think now...
So you're saying something subtly there that's very complicated, that may be true as far as I know, but I think it's better to say it out loud if you are saying that, which is, if you're saying that Israel needed a pretext to go into Gaza because there's oil and gas off the Gaza Strip, and this is all, to some extent, it's a big conspiracy theory. That's my problem there.
I think what I am saying is that, in a way, where Israel finds itself now is not necessarily against Israeli interests, but this is exactly how Hamas have operated consistently over the years, have acted in ways which is not in Palestinian interests. And what they've effectively done by this attack at the beginning of October is created a scenario which is not in Palestinian interests.
Okay, that's interesting, because in 2005, the international community and the Israelis thought that the Palestinian Authority were going to control Gaza, because George W. Bush said in a joint press conference with Ariel Sharon, "I support Sharon's initiative to disengage from Gaza. I urge the Palestinian leadership to accept his offer." It was $50 million to the Palestinian Authority was offered by the United States to help ensure that Gaza disengagement was a success. So it's clear that's what they were hoping for. And then that didn't happen. And as we know, and I agree with you, Netanyahu wanted to split the Palestinian leadership. But it sounds to me like that genuinely was what the sort of liberal Israeli community wanted, and perhaps what the Americans wanted, that there would be a Palestinian Authority control of both territories.
So interestingly, what I said at the time, David, when Hamas won those elections, and I think this is one of the mistakes that we made, as soon as Hamas won those elections, most of the world disengaged with them. My instinct is we should have gone the other way. We should have said, OK, well, you've won democratically through the ballot box. These are our requirements to how we want you to govern. Because actually, democracy isn't just winning elections. It's about the rule of law. It's about having an independent judiciary. It's about rights for individuals. It's about rights for minorities. It's about all of those things. But unfortunately, what we did was we disengaged. The US disengaged, the UK disengaged. And then we effectively put them there as mad outsiders. Whereas what we should have done at that point would be to say, OK, you've won a free and fair election. You've now got a democratic mandate. The international community is going to engage with you. And these are our conditions. And if they hadn't met those conditions, then we could have applied various sanctions. But we didn't. I think we genuinely made a huge mistake at that point.
OK.
So coming back to the question.
Well, I don't know. I do tend to say occupation. I think it's a little bit like what we've often said about Islamophobia, which is, for me, that, you know, as for you, and anti-Semitism, that's not exactly a perfect phrase. It's the word that people use to describe a thing that is understood. I think that I'm not that fussed. The people get so upset about language. And obviously, pro-Israeli Jews feel that occupation is another thing, another brick in the wall of the pure assumption that the Israeli state and everything it does is utterly evil. But I think that effectively occupation certainly describes what's going on in the West Bank. And although I think technically maybe siege would be a better word to describe what's happening in Gaza before October the 7th, I don't think that sounds any better. The people who are trying to make it sound better for Israel should perhaps stick with occupation. That's what I feel.
Yeah. Disputed territories is the word that's preferred by Israel, but occupied territories is the word that is recognised in international law, recognised by the UN, by the International Red Cross, by almost every country across the world, and is UK policy. So in law and in fact, unfortunately, however much the word may upset certain Israelis, it is occupied territory for now.
Shall we move on?
Yes. This is a question from an anonymous listener. So this anonymous listener says, I am a devout atheist who struggled from a young age with a theism that was forced upon me. I have never felt able to come out about my atheism to my largely Muslim family, friends or colleagues, as it feels very taboo. I wonder what you think of my belief that ex-Muslims have a harder time from Muslims than ex-Jews or ex-Christians do from Jews and Christians. David, he asks, did you experience a backlash from Jewish people when you first openly talked about being an atheist? This is a brilliant question, actually. And I suppose I can understand why somebody's saying they want to be anonymous. Over to you, David. Did you experience a backlash from Jewish people?
I am openly an atheist, and I sometimes talk about my atheism. I use my atheism as a trump card to get out of doing things that I'm asked to do by the Jewish community. And I was asked to light the menorah on Hanukkah by my local rabbi. I don't know how my local rabbi, since I never got to go to synagogue, got my phone number, but it must be because we control the world. And he said to me, will you come and do it? And I felt I didn't want to do it. So I played my trump card. I said, I'm sorry to tell you this, rabbi, I'm an atheist. And he said, so am I. And I thought, fuck me, there's more than I realised out there. And that, although that was a joke on his part, I imagine that he wasn't completely joking, the rabbi, because many Jews will see being Jewish as much more a matter of ritual and culture and identity than they will actual belief, actual literal belief in a supernatural being. And I do get the occasional thing on the internet from Jews who say, you're supposed to be somebody who represents Jews, but you don't even believe in Judaism, which I don't. But it's very rare. And that is an important thing in terms of talking about this person, because, of course, one reason why this person might wish to be anonymous is you can, I very much doubt it would happen in this case, but I believe the punishment for apostasy for Muslims is death. Is that not correct?
No, that's one interpretation of it.
Right.
And it's a very narrow interpretation of it. But I think there are two parts to this question, David. First of all, as far as Islam is concerned, there's no compulsion in religion and in faith. And that's very clearly stated in the Quran. It's Surah Baqarah, verse 256, if anybody wants to look it up. Secondly, the onus in Islam is actually all about self. So it's not like Catholicism. You don't have to go through an official holy person who can then get you a connection to God. Your relationship with God is a very personal relationship. And whether you believe or not, is between you and God, not between you and other people. And there's a fantastic article. When I was looking at this question, I was looking at this article from Nasreen Malik. She's a Guardian columnist. And she makes a really interesting distinction between atheists and ex-Muslims. Because this question talks about atheism, but then it talks about ex-Muslims. And I think the issue is that if you declare yourself as an atheist, that's very different to declaring yourself as an ex-Muslim. The former, saying that you're an atheist, is like a personal theological position. The latter, I think, is a political position. And I think that the point is that sometimes it's much easier being an atheist, but I think it's much harder when you take a position of being an ex-Muslim and therefore you're challenging the status of other Muslims. And I've had that. I've had ex-Muslims have a go at me for all sorts of things. And I find it interesting that when you talk about being an atheist, you don't say I'm an ex-Jew. You say I'm an atheist.
No. What I say is I'm an atheist Jew. That's how I define myself. And I would never describe myself as an ex-Jew. I'm an atheist Jew for a number of reasons. But the key reason why Jews can describe themselves as atheists and Jews is that I am an atheist. That would have made no difference to whether or not I ended up in Auschwitz. That's the thing, right? As far as I'm concerned, a lot of how you identify as a minority depends on the racism that you face. And the racism that you face doesn't care whether or not you keep kosher, whether you go to synagogue, whether indeed you believe in God. Racists will think that I'm a dirty Jew whatever my belief system is, that I don't believe at all in God. As it happens, if you read my very good book, The God Desire, yeah, you'll discover that I keep certain Jewish traditions because I find them moving and I find them lyrical, and I like the idea of, you know, my kids and people around me partaking of the culture. I find it emotional to do, but it has literally zero connection with any idea of a supernatural being actually engaging with any of these songs or prayers or whatever. But I think that, I don't know how specific that is to Judaism. I've never heard, not just Muslims, but Christians. I've never heard a Christian describe themselves as an atheist Christian or an atheist Muslim. I'm not sure that's possible.
There's this really interesting Gallup poll that was done around the world as to the number of people who define themselves as atheists. And 5% of people in Saudi Arabia define themselves as atheists. Saudi citizens define themselves as atheists, which was about the same percentage as those that define themselves as atheists in the United States, and about the same percentage that define themselves as atheists in Palestine. So about 4% of people in the West Bank and Gaza define themselves as atheists. So I think atheism is not an alien concept to Muslim societies. It hasn't, never has been, and I think it continues to be a part of Muslim societies. But it's very different to this concept of ex-Muslims, which is a politicized position. And historically, when I looked at this issue of ex-Muslims, the relationship between people who define themselves as ex-Muslims and neoconservative right-wingers who promote Islamophobia, there was this unholy alliance around some sections of those two communities. And I think that's the bit which might be problematic politically. But I think socially or from a family perspective, I don't think it's any different to anybody else coming home and saying, I think I'm now an atheist. Because the number of Jewish families who will say to me, I want my kids to marry in, I want them to stay within the kind of cultural religious framework of what they consider to be Judaism, is probably the same in all families. I think it's just a natural reaction. The issue is, when does that natural reaction within families wanting to keep their own close to them change into social censorship and eventually things like violence around a very narrow interpretation of what they consider to be apostasy laws?
Yeah, just to bring it back to the anonymous listener, who is, I suspect, anonymous because he or she is worried about a reaction to this if they were known, does call himself, I'm going to assume it's a man, an ex-Muslim insofar as he just uses the phrase. I wonder what your thoughts were on my belief that ex-Muslims have a harder time from Muslims than ex-Jews or ex-Christians. He is slightly misunderstanding, because when he asks me, did I experience a backlash from Jewish people when you first opened me talking about being an atheist, I don't call myself an ex-Jew and would never call myself an ex-Jew. So it's very specific in terms of my experience. But I guess this guy does consider himself an ex-Muslim and does consider that a secret. He says it feels very taboo. I don't know. You're right, I think, the politicization of it. It feels to me like he is talking more about finding it difficult to come out, he uses that phrase as well, to his family about it. Mm. And that's a very personal thing, isn't it? Mm. And if you're right, which I'm not suggesting you're not, but if you're right that within Muslim traditions, you know, there is a framework in which you can be an atheist, he shouldn't have a problem with that. And in a way, you're being an agony aunt here, and saying maybe he should go to his family and say, no, there is a scholarly tradition that allows for this.
The only thing I would say to anonymous listener is there are members of my wider family and friend circle who at times have come to me and said in these words, I don't think I believe anymore. And at moments like that, what I've said to them is, that's fine, because sometimes you don't. Even somebody like me who considers themselves to be a believing Muslim has moments when my belief is stronger and sometimes it's weaker. And the advice that I gave to this young person when they came to me was, treat it a bit like a safety parachute. Stick it in the back of your pocket. And if you ever need it, it's there. And if you don't need it, then just leave it there. It's not bothering you. And I think that's the way that I would advise people, that religion is such a personal thing. Sometimes it's a big part of your life. Sometimes it's never a part of your life, depending on what's going on in your own personal life. Often when you face challenges, even those that aren't religious suddenly feel the need to pray to something to give them comfort. It is effectively like a comfort. It's a safety net. So I would say to an anonymous listener that you'd be surprised. Maybe try talking to members of your family and friends, and you'll find so many of them will hopefully understand, and you'll continue to be a part of this culture.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Next question.
This is a question number three for you, Saida, from James. That's all we have is James. James says, does Saida think anyone will dare to write a comedy musical similar to the Book of Mormon with Islam at the centre of it and not Christianity? So this, can I just say before you answer that question, Saida, occasionally this comes up in my Twitter feed when if I make a joke about Christianity, which occasionally I do, I make a joke about Jesus, basically. I get people who want to have a go at me saying, oh, yeah, let's see you do a joke about Muhammad now. They'll say you wouldn't make a joke about Islam. And the truth is, I wrote a film and a musical called The Infidel, which is about a Jew, a Muslim who discovered that he was born a Jew, which had loads and loads of jokes in it about Jews and Muslims. It didn't. It's correct, actually, in one respect. It absolutely didn't have jokes about anything sacred because I was aware of that and I wanted to avoid blasphemy because I didn't want to be killed. But there are lots and lots of jokes about many things to do with both cultures. And in the musical, there's slightly more things that people think you can't joke about. So I may get killed for this, but there is a song in the musical in which the hate preacher figure does a ska song called Put a Fatwa on It, which goes, put a fatwa on it, put a fatwa on it, put a fatty fatwa on it. And then there's another song called Sexy Burqa, which is sung by the character who wears a burqa in it. Can I play it to you?
Yeah, of course you can. Fire away.
Okay, all right. So we're not actually in the same place. I'm in Mumbai and you're in, where are you?
I'm in Wakefield. I'm in Shaky Wakey listening to Sexy Burqa, as we'd say.
Shaky.
Let's have a look. Is it going to make me do a Shaky Wakey?
That sounds ruder than I think you wanted.
You don't have to wear.
A bit of it.
When you told me to actually type in Sexy Burqa, I did that into my thing.
What came up?
There's some really interesting costumes. It's a real fetish here, isn't there, about Sexy Burqas?
Oh, trust me, as someone, I'm just going to say this, who watches pornography, there is a whole niche of very overdressed Muslim women taking their clothes off. But that isn't the point of Sexy Burqa. Sexy Burqa, which I wrote the lyrics to, I don't agree that you can't write funny things, including a musical about Muslims. I do agree that unlike Book of Mormon, you would have to stray away from anything that was actually blasphemous or sacrilegious or deeply offensive to the faith. So I can make jokes about burqas, I can make jokes about hate preachers. I wouldn't make jokes about the Quran. I wouldn't make jokes about Muhammad. As a comedy writer and somebody who has written a comedy musical that involves Muslims, I would dispute James that no one would dare to write it because I have, but I could tell you when I was writing it that in conversation with Muslims who were on that production, I knew where the line was. The line was, I can make jokes about burqas, I can make jokes about hate preachers, I can make jokes about not eating during Ramadan, things like that, but I'm not going to make jokes about the actual sacred objects of faith because that is dangerous. And that is different from Book of Mormon, which does have some very offensive, in inverted commas, things about Jesus in it and God.
Okay. So first of all, let me start with this. Can you make jokes about Muslims? Yes, you can. And there is a massive Muslim comedy scene out there that laughs both at Muslims and with Muslims. Secondly, can you joke about Islam and Muslims in the United Kingdom? Because there's always this kind of, oh, we're never allowed to speak about this stuff when we talk about it all the time. So yes, you can joke about Islam and Muslims in the UK because the law permits it under the Religious and Racial Hatred Act. There is a specific exemption that protects that right. So in reality, is it done? Yes. In law, is it allowed? Yes. But then the third point of this is, should we go around making jokes about other people's belief systems or what other people consider to be sacrosanct or sacred? I'm not sure that I would be able to produce and write a play taking the mick out of Israel and Jews and Judaism and be allowed to put that on the stage and to get away with it without everybody screaming at me about how this was unacceptable and probably get cancelled for it. There was a play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, which was played at the Young Vic. And again, there were concerns about this going out. And the chairman of the Zionist Federation at the time, Paul Charney, I think he's called, said that if people wanted to protest against this, then he could understand that and he'd support those protests. So people protesting about things that they consider to be an attack on their faith, their religion, their identity, their Judaism, what they consider to be sacred, isn't just confined to Muslims. And I think often we are quite narrow in the way in which we see this as far as Muslims are concerned.
No death threats. No death threats. My name is Rachel Corrie. No death threats. Petition. No death threats. People getting upset, of course, but no one went into hiding because of it. And I can promise you, I mean, you know, Theo van Gogh was killed, right? Because he did something which was considered offensive. It was considered offensive. So that's the distinction.
And it can never be defined. I think that's where I do agree that you can never, ever justify. There's one thing about talking about what an inclusive, liberal, compassionate, civilized nation looks like. But the other side of it is you can never, ever justify killing in the name of a faith. You cannot justify killing people in the name of Islam because you're offended by what they said. It wasn't done during the time of the Prophet. It isn't sanctioned. So if people want to go about because they've taken offense at something, because they feel like they want to do this and they want to go out and kill, that is not sanctioned by Islam and it's not within the teachings of Islam. Those are people who are killers and murderers, not because they're Muslim.
A couple of things that I don't think we have said before. Number one, the Book of Mormon is a specific example that is not quite right. People always imagine like you can just transplant X and then it's Y. But the Book of Mormon is a comedy musical about Christianity. Christianity in the West is the majority religion. Because it's the majority religion, people can make jokes about it and quite offensive, again, in inverted commas, jokes about it because that's where the power is considered to be. This is just, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. This is how it works artistically. That's where the power is considered to be. And if the power is there, then you're allowed to make more jokes. That is why the Book of Mormon gets away with it. Christianity is seen as fair game because it is religiously or culturally the power in the way that a minority religion would not be. So that's that. Something else, which is, I think you do have to accept, or maybe you don't, but this is how I feel about it. I think there is a specific thing with Islam and specific with blasphemy around Islam. So all those other examples might create trouble. You might get into trouble. People tend to use the Holocaust as an example of something that Jews hold sacred. But it's only really making fun of the sacred objects. And I make a distinction here, by the way, because I completely agree that there are many types of comedies about Muslims, but sacred objects, making fun of the Prophet, making fun of the Quran, that is very dangerous. That you are liable to get into types of trouble for that is not there with other religions. And that's just true, isn't it?
I hear what you say, David, but I don't agree with you because I genuinely believe that if you were to make plays about things that were considered to be sacred to Hindus or sacred to Sikhs or sacred to lots of other religions, you would get a similar reaction. And I genuinely think that in each religion, in each belief system, there are things that are considered to be sacred to them. And I think what I consider to be quite worrying is that often when we talk about Islam in what I think is this quite reductive way to say you as a religion are uniquely wound up about these things and are uniquely likely to take umbrage and are uniquely, that is not correct. And if you're in India, if you look around you, one of the biggest issues at the moment is the level of people who consider themselves to be practicing Hindus, for example, who take umbrage at all sorts of things, including places and people and temples and statues and animals and all sorts of things. And people kill off the back of this. So it's really important that we don't see Islam in that reductive way.
Okay, fine. I'm talking about in the West. I'm talking about Western people making art, comedy, whatever, that is seen as offensive specifically to sacrilegious objects. To choose, you see, I can't even say it on this podcast, so you'll know what I'm going to say, but there's an offensive song. Yeah, I don't find it offensive, obviously, I'm an atheist, but and no one really finds it offensive, including even Mormons, but there's a bit where the Ugandan villages in Book of Mormon sing a song which goes, "Fuck you, God." Right, now, you could not put the Muslim word for God into that sentence. I'm not going to do it now on this podcast without causing yourself enormous threat. So that, it just is a difference. What I'm saying is I would not put the word Allah into that sentence. I would not feel safe doing that, certainly singing a comedy song with that in it. And I wrote a comedy musical and I was fine to put fatwa in. I was fine to put burqa in to a song because I think, well, these, although these are Muslim things, they're not held as entirely sacred. You're absolutely right that in India, you know, the Cow Protection League, who I've been reading about recently, I shouldn't laugh because it's terrible, but go around killing people if they feel that they're trading in beef or even have beef in their fridge. You're absolutely right that that does happen. But I guess the question, which is about Book of Mormon, is about sort of Western liberal culture and its tendency to sometimes satirise offensively rather than about the world in general.
My sense is that we have to decide what kind of a nation we want to be. Do we want to be the nation that accepts mocking something that other people hold sacred for gratuitous purposes? I don't think is that what we're becoming as a civilized society?
I think we should move on.
There's a question here to you from Saad. Saad asks, a couple of podcasts ago, David mentioned that Richard Dawkins' comments on Islam is not Islamophobia. Dawkins said in an interview that he is slightly horrified to see lights celebrating Ramadan in central London during Easter and worries about a replacement in this regard. Is Dawkins' criticism of the open displays celebrating Ramadan in London Islamophobic? Aren't lights celebrating Ramadan a part of our rich multiculturalism, Assad? I don't remember you defending Richard Dawkins, did you?
I would always probably defend Richard Dawkins for various reasons, although I would then qualify my defence of Richard Dawkins. So I probably did. I probably said, just as a starting position, that Richard Dawkins, as probably the world's most famous atheist, and much more down on religion than I am as an atheist, because I actually quite approve of religion. I think religion is a great hive for storytelling and for understanding humanity. But he doesn't like religion. He's anti all religion. And so therefore, his comments on Islam need to be seen in that framework. Having said that, I think I would say him saying that he's horrified to see lights celebrating Ramadan in central London, weirdly, is the first case that is definitely Islamophobia, I would say, we're sure about the phrase. I would say that is totally Islamophobia. It's someone being slightly phobic about seeing the acceptance of Islam as part of our culture. So whether I defended him or not a few podcasts ago, I would say it's almost the dictionary definition of Islamophobia, that particular comment.
So I find Dawkins' response to the Ramadan lights exactly like you. I mean, what is this about? We've had Diwali lights, we've had menorahs, we have lights for celebrating all sorts of religious festivals. Christmas lights have been a part of our tradition forever. So we ended up with some twinkly fairy lights marking Ramadan. I couldn't understand why this guy was having a complete meltdown about it, other than the fact that obviously he has an issue with Islam and Muslims and Ramadan. So it was probably a classic case of just getting, what's my word always I use, getting vexed about some fairy lights, but clearly through that showing his prejudice.
I think I'm more of an atheist than Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is a good example of someone who was brought up in Christianity and can't quite get Christianity out of his system. Whereas I accept Judaism as part of who I am. I just don't believe that the Hebrew God exists in any way. So I'm incredibly comfortable with it. And so I'm just a total stone cold disbeliever in God. And what I can able to do, because I'm also a member of a minority, is understand how religion is an important part of one's identity. That's something that Richard Dawkins and some of the other new atheists completely can't understand when they're being dismissive of religion. You don't need to be dismissive of religion to be an atheist. At all, I don't think. And he does it all the time.
So I think what I found about Richard Dawkins was that he was really sensationalist, because what he said was that he felt that with these kind of twinkly fairy lights, Islam was being promoted, quote, And I just think that, you know, can you imagine somebody saying, well, because we've got Diwali rites, I think that Hinduism is being promoted and forced upon us, or Hanukkah is being promoted and Judaism is being forced upon us as a Christian country. I just think it was just a sensationalist way by which he used these fairly innocuous lights, and he then promoted that into some sort of a kind of a culture war. And then he linked it to the fact that the mayor of London had turned on these lights. And by the way, the mayor of London turns on all lights. In fact, you said he was there when you were lighting the menorah. But the fact that this mayor of London was, oh, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, a Muslim, and therefore he was turning on these Muslim lights, and these Muslim lights were going to promote Islam, just completely bonkers. I also think that Dawkins is quite disingenuous, because in that same interview where he talked about these fairy lights, he said that cathedrals and hymns he's okay with, and that's a kind of part of what he sees as Christianity, but then he finds aspects of Islam are troubling. But I can't understand when he says cathedrals and hymns are all right, but I find historic Christian connections to slavery or colonialism or the Holocaust are really troubling aspects of Christianity. I just find it really disingenuous when people compare the best of one against the worst of another and then say that's why one is good and the other is bad. That's a really disingenuous way to talk about faith.
Yeah, that's correct. Also, just like Ramadan as being something that quite a lot of citizens of Britain would be celebrating, you know, that's what it's there for. It's not really there to promote Islam as a greater thing. And I agree with you as well that his version of Christianity is a very kind of Middle England villagey version of Christianity and does miss out the Inquisition, for example, and the solid murder of Jews over many centuries and all sorts of other things about Christianity. I'm going to defend him a little bit. This is how I'm going to defend him. I think that his position is that, or at least I think there is an intellectual confusion between his notion of Islam and what he considers to be the maltreatment of people in the name of Islam. So I have heard him say, I don't like Islam because, and then he will talk about gay people being executed and women being subjected and all the other things that do happen in Muslim theocracies around the world in the name of Islam. You might be going to say, I suspect you are, that those are perversions of the faith. But he will say that's why he doesn't like Islam. And he's right insofar as there aren't that many existing perversions of Christianity like the Inquisition anymore. So if you're going to think of it in those terms, then I think that's why he's saying, oh, I prefer Christianity to Islam.
I think what I find fascinating, and this is why I just see this as the exceptionalization of the way in which Islam is singled out for these criticisms, whilst other religions are given a free pass. That's the bit that I find anti-Muslim racist. Because if you want to talk about the way women's rights are depicted in the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, or gay rights are viewed in the various religious texts, or historically how these rights have been implemented in society, how now they're being implemented in different societies, how the US sees religion and abortion rights and women's rights to contraception, how Christians in Africa see gay rights, how Muslims in East Asia see women's rights, gay rights. Across the world, if you look across the world, there are ways in which every religion is being interpreted in a way which diminishes other people's rights. What I don't like about people like Dawkins is that they are disingenuous, they are illogical, and actually, I'm afraid, they are deeply prejudiced in the way in which they single out their conversation of this. And I just expect better from somebody who's apparently supposed to know better.
I would say there's a difference between like individual states ruling idiotically on women's rights because sometimes of a Christian basis and disputed all over America and leading to a debate in America about women's rights, for example. You're right about Africa, some African countries and LGBTQ rights in the name of Christianity, obviously. But there's a difference between that and, say, Iran, which, by the way, there's loads and loads of protests in Iran, which is amazing, and I always think brilliant when that happens. But nonetheless, there is a theocracy in Iran or in Afghanistan, which has medieval ideas, supposedly in the name of Islam, sanctioned by the state. And that is more common in the name of Islam, that there are bad men. I don't know why we can't just say this. It's slightly more common. You're right, it happens in other countries, but it's slightly more common that in the name of Islam, bad men are trying to propose medieval things, mainly on women, but sometimes on gay people or whatever. Is that not fair? Is Richard Dawkins completely wrong to imagine that?
I agree with you on that, but I also say that if you want to be a student of history and you look across the world, women in the Muslim world were ruling their countries, were actually on the battlefields, were prime ministers and presidents long before they started to become prime ministers and presidents in the Western world. So I don't accept this notion of the Western world being so enlightened in relation to, and that somehow in relation to women's rights and LGBT rights, the Muslim world forever having been this unenlightened space. This is why I think these conversations are nuanced, and I am prepared to have the complex, nuanced conversation on this. I'm not prepared to have the dim Dawkins version of it.
Okay, let's move on. Oh, that's it. Is that it for this episode?
Oh, that's it. We got to the end of our questions.
Yeah, that was great, actually. Thank you, listeners, for the great questions. I'm currently in India and Saeed is going to Pakistan for a few weeks, so next episode is also going to be a Q&A. Please keep sending in your questions as usual.
Do you want to come and meet me at the Wagga border?
Yeah, I do.
If you come to the Indian side of the Wagga border and I come to the Pakistani side, I'll be able to wave through. You know what? We could record our podcast at the Wagga border.
Yeah, let's
do that.
So
next week, we're going to have another Q&A. So please do keep sending in your questions. The email address is podcast@instinctproductions.com, or you can send us questions via Twitter @AMuslimAndAJew.
Muslim and a Jew, Go There was brought to you by Instinct Productions.